My sister did not deserve to be forgotten, and today we finally heard him say what he did. Those are the paraphrased words of the sister of Gilgo Beach victim Maureen Brainerd Barnes. And tonight, the man accused of being the Gilgo Beach serial killer, now convicted, stood in court. He said guilty over and over while families cry just feet away. And in just a second, you're going to hear from one of the better true crime reporters in this entire country. And she was inside the courtroom with a convicted Long Island serial killer.
Welcome to the global phenomenon, Surviving the Survivor, where we bring you the best guests in all of true crime. Here's your host, Emmy Award-winning journalist, Joel Waldman.
What's up, SDS Nation? Welcome to Surviving the Survivor. It is the global phenomenon because we have more than 50 countries represented in our community. Count them, 50-plus countries. And tonight, we are talking about a story that has plagued Long Island for the better part of 30 years. You go back, actually, to 1993, not 1933. That's the year my father was born, but 1993. You do the math, and it is 33 years that this story has really been plaguing that eastern portion of Long Island. But today in court, a lot of that sort of came to a head with Rex Heuermann now pleading guilty to 7 murders and admitting to an 8th victim, Karen Vergata. No trial, no drawn-out testimony, just one word repeated over and over, guilty. And here to help us break this down, she runs the YouTube channel, The Engel Edit. She and her husband, they visit crime scenes and courthouses, and she does that on her days off from her day job at News Nation. One of the best true crime reporters and people in the country, Laura Engel, is here. Thank you, Laura, for being here. Next up, we're going around the horn. Mike Alcazar, retired NYPD detective, who's been following the case incredibly closely, as has David Sarney, retired NYPD detective. And we've got a full house here today because Dr. Casey Jordan, criminologist and attorney, I don't like to do this, but when Laura Engel, who is inside the courtroom, agrees to come on, you bring her on. Real quickly, I just want to read the names of the victims because today is their day. It's not Rex Heuermann's day. Melissa Barthelemy, Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Megan Waterman, Amberlynn Costello, Jessica Taylor, Valerie Mack, Sandra Castilla, Karen Vergata. Laura Engel, thank you for being here. We've got a lot of sound that we're going to play tonight, but you're getting the inside scoop on the courtroom. Take us in there. I talked to you last night. You said court was going to open up to reporters and media about 9, but court wouldn't actually start till 11. What was the scene like this morning?
It was definitely chaotic. It was every bit what we thought it was going to be, with the world media showing up. Doors opened at 9, and there was a very long and substantial line, and depended on what kind of pass you had. I have got a secure pass with the New York court, so I was allowed to bypass the security line, which is where you really get held up. And once you got into the courtroom, they held us there for a few minutes outside of the courtroom doors, let us in. And for the first time, I think I've ever seen this, the courtroom itself was divided in half, with members of the district attorney's team sitting in the middle of each row, creating a line. And the media was to be on the left side. And we said, what's going on? We usually have, you know, the first few rows. And they said the entire right half of the seats was going to be for victims' family members. And we know, of course, that we were talking about 7. And then we found out 8 family members of multiple people from each person. And then the Gilgo Beach task force filled the room, coming in and lining shoulder to shoulder up against the walls, and took every single empty seat. And it took my breath away, because you realize how long this investigation, the detectives, the FBI, people with the Suffolk County DA's office, with the Sheriff's Department, all came in to see their hard work pay off to hear the words. And the judge even said, okay, everybody's here because of, apparently of the worst kept secret in the county, that there's about to be a plea change. And with that, they brought in Rex Huerman, and he came in out of that holding area behind the door to the left of the judge's station there and came into the well of the court. They took care of a couple of matters, and then it was on, and they swore him in, and they handed it over to Ray Tierney, and he asked him if he caused the death of each and every victim that he was charged with. The answer, yes, and asked how he killed each victim. Manner was the manner and means of strangulation. So it was the first time we heard strangulation, and it was the first time we certainly heard him say that out loud. And with that, we heard kind of that. You could just feel the emotion from the people, from all of the family members. And it was emotional for everyone. You know, you're talking about a guy that's over 6 feet, you know, close to 6'3", 6'4", 280 pounds. Maybe he's less now. But the sheer magnitude of this man, and then knowing each and every one of his victims is about 100 pounds, was about 5 feet, 100 pounds. And you just think about this person stopping the heartbeat of eight individual people through the years, through 1993 to 2010. It was breathtaking.
Laura, thank you. I'm coming right back to you. Laura has about 40, 45 minutes. So I'm gonna go heavy on Laura. But Dr. Jordan, you've interviewed a lot of serial killers and a lot of killers in your time. What do you think was rolling around Rex Huerman's head today? He seemed to be emotionless. He seemed to just answer. We have some video. I'm going to show you that. We heard from Laura that the most important people, obviously the victims' families, were devastated. Does this guy care at all about what he has done to these victims?
No, not at all. He's a really good candidate to be a psychopath. I mean, we joke, but it's not funny, about how we would love to have some, you know, good old fashioned 70s and 80s serial killers who actually wanted to be in the limelight and wanted to be on trial and wanted the attention. And I'm not trying to be cute here, but that seems to have changed. I mean, Brian Koberger said that he wasn't going to take a plea, and then he was there in court. Guilty, guilty, guilty. I liken this one the most, perhaps, to BTK. And about 20 years ago, you know, Dennis Rader not only took a plea on all of the, you know, no trial on everybody that he killed, but they made him articulate not just means, manner of death, strangulation, which was important to make Rex Huerman say, but to go into even greater detail about each and every one, how he gained access to the house and what exactly he did to them. And I like an articulation because, believe it or not, the victims' families feel like that gets the truth out and that gets justice. I'm really happy that this is behind us, you know, for the victims' families. But I wasn't surprised at all that he just flatlined us. Guilty, guilty, guilty. There is no atheist in a foxhole. Everyone says, we're going to go to trial. I'm not going to take a plea. I'm innocent. I'm innocent. And almost always when it comes to the day of reckoning where they got to have a trial, they can't do it because then they're going to have to actually articulate and be faced with the details of their crimes. And then suddenly they're like, yeah, I think I might actually just take a plea after all. He's going to go to prison. He's going to be there the rest of his life. My heart breaks for the victims' families, but I also have a soft spot for Rex Huerman's family because they had no way of knowing. They didn't know a thing. And they have a sense of guilt, I think, that they don't deserve. But at least now we can move on with the victims' families finding some peace.
And that was my next question to you. There's a lot of mixed feelings about what Asa Ellerup knew and didn't know. Laura, I know you interviewed her yesterday, and I know you try to remain impartial because you're a great journalist. But, I mean, what, do you have an impression of that, like how much they did know, the family, and how much they didn't know?
Well, let's start with what the Suffolk County DA has said in court filings, that they do not believe that the family knew or had anything to do with any of it, a cover-up, part of it, any of it. And of course, there has been paperwork that was filed this week by an attorney, John Ray, who represented Shannon Gilbert's family and who's representing the son of Valerie Mack. And he filed a lawsuit against Rex Huerman and of the family, talking about the Peacock deal and the documentary series that's being done with them, saying that they shouldn't be profiting off of any of these crimes. But who I interviewed really was Bob Macedonio, who is Asa Ellerup's attorney. And they had a press conference right outside on the front lawn of the Huerman home in Massapequa Park yesterday. It was kind of a hastily called press conference. We didn't know that that was coming. So those of us that could got out there, and I got up, and you know this, Joel, from like running up at a press conference, and my mic didn't quite make it onto the stand there. And so when everybody left, I said, hey, can you give me a few minutes? And because of the wind and the cold, we ended up doing it on the front porch. And as I was interviewing Bob to ask him to recap what he had just said, Asa Ellerup, who had gone inside, opened the door and she came out. She was having a cup of coffee. She was kind of leaning on the screen door watching us. And Bob said, you know, why don't you come out? She came out and she took a seat and she just more listened to me interviewing Bob, but did chime in a couple of times. And he said, you know, we're not going to have you make any statements. And that's obviously for legal reasons. But she basically had just said, you know, when the question came up of why are you still living here, many people have asked, why are you living in the house that many people believe these crimes were committed in? It's not been put out publicly by the Suffolk County DA, but today Rex Huerman himself said that the crimes he committed were committed in Nassau County. So
do you get the sense that she's got the empathy and remorse that Rex does not for these victims' families? Do you get the sense that she feels that?
I do. I mean, she made a statement today after court and that it was about the victim's family members and that, you know, I think that she, I don't know what happened in the last few months. Obviously, she knew that this plea was coming and there probably was a conversation that was had, maybe at the jail, I would assume, or a phone call where he said, I've changed my mind. And she has long maintained that the line is that she did not believe the man she was married to for over 20, 25 years could be capable of these crimes. She has been trying to wrap her head around that, according to her own words. And if you watch the Peacock documentary, if you listen to her talk and you talk about the vulnerability of her in the relationship, you know, she calls Rex Huerman throughout the Peacock doc, you know, her hero. He saved her. He saved her from a bad relationship when they first got together. And so that's how she viewed Rex Huerman. And that's who many might say that he preyed upon, somebody that was vulnerable, somebody that maybe he could pull the wool over their eyes. That's kind of the narrative that has been going on throughout this story.
Yeah. Here's a little piece, speaking of the story of Rex actually in court today, that was released. Let's watch this together and then I'll get to the men in blue, the NYPD, New York's finest. But here you go.
Mr. Huerman, before I saw you when the allocution was taken, I had some questions to ask of you. They're obvious and simple questions, but I have to ask them. Okay?
Yes, Your Honor.
How old are you?
62.
Do you read and write English?
Yes.
Have you discussed this case with your attorney?
Yes, I have.
Have you had enough time to discuss this case with your attorney?
Yes, I have.
After discussions with your lawyer, you feel it's in your best interest to plead guilty rather than go to trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you satisfied with the manner in which your attorney's represented you in this case?
Yes, I am.
I must say that the attorneys on both sides of this case have been excellent, unbelievable lawyers. Do you understand that by pleading guilty to a charge, that is the same as if you had gone to trial and been found guilty of that charge?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you understand that by pleading guilty, you're waiving a number of very important rights?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Now, these rights include your right to a trial by jury or by the court, your right to have the prosecution produce evidence and witnesses to prove your guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, your right to cross-examine those witnesses, and your right to testify on your own behalf or to remain silent, your right to call witnesses or submit evidence on your behalf. Do you understand those rights as I just explained?
Yes.
Do you understand that by pleading guilty, you're giving up those rights?
Yes, I do. All
right. I'm going to hold it right there. Mike, let me go to you. One of the things that came up with Michael Brown, Rex Huerman's attorney outside the courthouse during an interview, one of the reasons that he gave for this plea deal was that he didn't want to, you know, put his family through it or the quote unquote, the victim's families. And I call a giant BS on that. There's no way this guy is thinking about the victim's families. Your take on that from the defense attorney, something Sarnie and I talked about earlier.
Yeah, I didn't buy it either. You can see that this guy is very charming. You can see that when he's listening to the judge, it's yes, sir, no, sir, and all this, right? He's nodding his head. He's very smug. He's even got a smile. I can see why this guy was able to lure these women as victims. Yeah, I don't believe he cares about the family. I don't believe he cares about his own family. I think he just didn't want to go through the trial, perhaps because he's a little bit of a narcissist. He didn't want to be embarrassed. He knew the conclusion was going to be the same. So he didn't want us to waste his time.
Interesting. I like the way you phrased that. Didn't want us to waste his time, which is probably right. David Sarney, and I'm going to pivot back to Laura about where she was in the courtroom in relation to all this. But David, how many more victims could be out there? And we talked about this earlier as well. I mean, he's said to have been in South Carolina, New Jersey, Nevada, you know, all over the country. Would you be surprised to find 5, 10, 15, 20 more victims eventually?
I wouldn't be surprised. You know, you've seen breaks in these type of serial killers. They'll break for a few years. Apparently, he didn't do the murders in his house. He was perfecting with his kind of his playbook. And when it comes to missing persons, and I've said this and I say it time again, it's not a crime to be missing. It's only criminal when we find out the reason why that person's missing. He selected individuals that he perceived to be lost souls, that they would, no one would care to look for them. And it was just easy pickings in a sense. Is his travels anywhere along those lines where he met others in his mindset, lost souls, that he could just, you know, do what he did, sadistic torture and strangulation of these women? There's going to I don't doubt there's more. They said this was a playbook. You're dealing with, you know, the initial, you know, with when you're talking about the first murder, that wasn't like the others. And then he decided to start burying him in Gilgo Beach. That's what this guy was. He was creating a playbook and he was going through this. And we don't know. We'll only know if we find more missing persons and we can identify those missings through any trace evidence in regarding this defendant, now inmate.
Dr. Jordan, and then to Laura, he did not start killing. This is a proclamation here from Rebecca. He did not start killing in his 30s. He would have been basically late 20s, early 30s in 1993, I think late 20s. But do you agree with that statement? And how many other victims could be out there, Dr. Jordan?
Well, I think if we do the math, he could have been killing, and the advent of that right around the age of 26, which is spot on for textbook date age starting to kill as a serial killer. There are two more in Long Island, which I would attribute to him, that would be from those very early days in the early 20s, but the DNA evidence is so far gone. And if he's not going to cop to it, we'll never be able to pin those two on him. But I am impressed that he went ahead and took, you know, pleas to all eight. I absolutely think there could be others out there. We know he was a hunter, that he, you know, went around to various states doing duck hunting and deer hunting. And I think that we just have to get comfortable with the idea that we may never know. He is not the kind of guy who would ever confess to crimes that he hasn't been accused of. Although he may play a post-conviction game of cat and mouse with authorities and say, you know, if you want to come and give me some certain, I don't know, put me in a better wing or give me better food and take me out, I can show you some crime scenes. We saw this happen. We see this happen. Green River Killer is one of the most famous, who wanted to just go out and walk around and say he could show them where other bodies were, when in fact he wasn't going to show them anything. But mostly I want to kind of piggyback on what Michael said. That's a smirk. That smile is like, you may be getting a conviction on me, but I got over on the system. I mean, I got away with 8, maybe 10, maybe more murders. And here I am standing here, and it's I'm making the decisions now. I'm doing you a favor. I'm going to plea because I'm in control here. I would love to tell you this man is a little bit more complicated than the most basic type of serial killer, but he's not. He is a very basic power control serial killer. Yes, there's a sexual component to it, but sex wasn't the point. Having power over them was the point, and strangulation, snuffing the life out of them, was the point. So
if you said to his face that he was a very average serial killer, would he be extremely offended by that?
Oh, no, he'd give me that little duper's delight. He'd give me that little smile that he's giving the judge. Mm. And he would just be, well, that's what you think, but I know more. And you would like to talk to me, wouldn't you? But I'm not going to talk to you. You criminologists all want to talk to me, but I hold all the cards. That's the way he would play this.
Well, Dr. Jordan, if you talk to him, I'm coming with you because I'm fascinated by these insane minds. Laura Engel, to you, one of the things I'm interested in. So did he actually when he was asked the manner and cause of death, did he say, yes, I strangled her? How was that phrased in court?
He was asked the means of how he killed them. And he just simply said he like leaned into the microphone and he said, strangulation for each one. And that's how that went. It was a Q&A. It was an allocution. It was, did you kill this person on or about the date that, you know, we know that they went missing and that they were murdered? Yes. How did you do it? Strangulation. Where did you do it? Did you do it in Nassau County? Yes. Did you dispose of their remains in Suffolk County? Yes. And that was that. But to 2 points, to your guest, you know, one of the things that we heard about, we know that this wasn't a plea deal. It was a plea agreement. And she's right. I mean, right now, one of the parts of this agreement is that he has to talk to the FBI behavioral unit, the behavior analysis unit. That's part of the agreement, that he is now going to be studied by that very specialized FBI team, number one. And number two, to the point of, why did he do it? Do you remember the whole butter for your bread thing? So when he was first arrested on these first initial charges, he was in communication with Keith Jesperson, the Happy Face Killer in Oregon. And the Happy Face Killer, Keith Jesperson, wrote Rex Huerman a letter saying, you should confess. You should just fess up to it, because if you do, you'll get a better job. You'll get better conditions. You'll get better food. You'll get better accommodations, this and that. Rex wrote back one and only one letter to him. And in that letter, he thanked him for his advice because his family had reached out to his family. So Jesperson's family reached out to Rex's family initially saying, we know what it's like to have a serial killer as a father. And they started a relationship. But the one question that Rex Huerman had for Keith Jesperson was, do you have butter for your bread? And that is something that seems so very small. But when you're talking about the rest of your life in prison, and if that's something that matters to you, and apparently it does, that was a question that he wanted answered. And so Keith Jesperson wrote him back and said, why, yes, and as a matter of fact, we do, sent him the menu. And I know this because Keith Jesperson wrote the same thing to me. He explained what he wrote to Rex Huerman, and he sent me the prison menus of where he's at to show what he sent to Rex, and showing this huge menu of things that you can get aside from food and all the different things you can get at the commissary. So Rex has been looking through that mail. I know that it was sent to him. And so if that played into it, we won't know it until he tells somebody.
That is unbelievably fascinating. And I'm going to clip that because it's fascinating. But I have to go back to Casey Jordan, and I'm coming to Mike and David. But Dr. Jordan, what is going on with the butter on the bread? Is that code, or is that really a guy that's, you know, Rex's size worrying about getting butter on his bread? Put it this way. It'd be the last thing on my mind if I was going to prison for the rest of my life. What's happening there? Well, you're muted. You have to unmute yourself, Casey.
Well, because. Still,
yeah, there you go. You're good now.
Joel, it's the last thing you would be concerned about, whether you have butter for your bread, because you're not a psychopath. And I don't mean to be cute here, but did you see his paunch? This man likes food. He likes food very, very much. He likes rich food. And if you are going to spend the rest of your life, which for him could be another 30, 35 years, you have no way of knowing. And he is going to have so few pleasures. I mean, in prison, he's not going to have consensual sex, certainly not with a female. He's going to have 1 hour a day, maybe, of exercise. He might get a book. He might get some letters every now and then. The one pleasure that he has left in life for the next 30 years is food. So I don't think it was code at all. I think he wants to know, if I give them little tidbits for their behavioral science people, you know, more details about the crimes that they really want to know, could I negotiate some butter for my bread? And Keith is like, yeah, dude, you can just cooperate and you will have better for your bread. It's not code. It is literally dairy butter that he is craving.
Detective Alcazar, I don't know why. That's very surprising to me. I guess it shouldn't be. I am the son of a psychiatrist and social worker, so I've heard just about everything. But that's just incredibly bizarre to me. Mike, what struck me about the press conference today with D.A. Tierney, and I'm going to get to Laura about that too, was just the amount of people there. You realize how much goes into an investigation like that. You know, typically you only see the Ray Tierney of the world. You're not seeing the, not that these guys were necessarily there, but he thanked the anthropologists. He thanked the wireless cell phone companies, the digital forensic analysts. What kind of team effort was it to get here today?
I mean, yeah, it was a big effort, right? It was a failure from the previous administration, and then the new administration reopened the case. You said he mentioned a lot of people. I don't believe he mentioned Rodney Harrison at all, who basically jump-started this case, right?
Good point. Great point.
He put more detectives on it. I think he started the wheel going and got it moving. So it was something happening there behind the scenes. I was very disturbed that he didn't mention Rodney at all. I was hoping that he would be there because he certainly deserves some of the credit. But yes, so Tierney credited a whole team. It was a big effort by everybody over there, deservedly so. And there was a lot of people, a lot of emotions. You know, what hit me the most was when the family started talking. I know you're going to cover that. I thought that was, this is why we do what we do, because for the family, right? For the surviving families of the victims.
Yeah. I mean, David, do you feel like law enforcement, someone in the comment section, by the way, thank you to Janet Warcraft for this, saying that you never suspect them. The guy is creepy looking. And David just dove off there right as I was coming to him. He's got a little bit shaky Wi-Fi. But Mike, let me come back to you since you're the only other detective here. Is there, you know, it's a team effort. It's literally a team. So is there some sort of, you know, like day after letdown? I mean, this kind of just came to like a screeching halt after all these years. Now, from what I understand, the investigation is basically closed. I don't know if that's true or not, if you can expound on that. But is there some sort of letdown that you feel after you're kind of finished with a very big case?
I mean, I wouldn't describe it as a letdown, maybe a sense of relief. You know, when you're going on a trial like this, I'm sure all those detectives were gearing up, getting ready to testify, and then that's taken away from them because this guy pled guilty. So I don't believe, it's a letdown. I think, again, like a sense of relief, a job well done, credit to all of them. And I think Tierney is recognizing everybody. So I think it's a good ending for the investigators.
Yeah. David, let me bring you back in here. I see, you know, Mike brings up a great point. Rodney Harrison sort of jump-started this. He was doing analysis for CBS Local in New York City. Was that a misstep or an oversight? I don't think it was an oversight from Ray Tierney to not mention him. He did help get this going, but this has always been very political.
Yeah, I was very surprised too. I mean, I know Chief Harrison, you know, we've dealt with him before in the NYPD. He's a good man. He helped spearhead this on the task force along with, the DA Tierney. Having Catalina there, also retired NYPD, becomes chief of department. I mean, the commissioner over there. It was unusual, but I don't know why that happened. But regardless of that, and I'll say it to the day I'm on the ground, if it was not for the detectives that worked this case in 1993, in 96, in 2001, 2000, throughout this 30 plus years, you would not be at the level you have here. That I won't even say his name, but this inmate will be forever put in prison because of what the work was done beforehand. The technology finally caught up to the great investigators. And that's the benefit of having detectives who care. We speak for the victims. We speak for the dead. And that's why we are at this level, at this particular point in time with this case. And I always say that's the reason why we're here. We work on the great precedents of people before us. And as detectives, we honor that legacy and continue the work forward, moving forward.
I know your answer to my question, but do you feel like it's a thankless job that you kind of wish you got a little more credit for what you guys do?
It's never, if it's been about ego or credit, I would have had a better paycheck. You do it because you want to do it. And that's what it comes down to. What, you know, Mike and I did training for detectives. And my thing is always, you're doing it for the victim. You do get a paycheck from the city, but there is always an innate reason to do what's right. It's not about doing the right thing. It's doing what's right. Justice is very arbitrary. No matter what happens, this person's in prison for the rest of his life. The families are still out there, loved ones. Justice is always different on that way. But we do what's right. And the detectives on this case, the analysts, the forensic anthropologists, you know, this is what we do. We do these things to make it right. You know, LA Confidential has that whole line about, you know, we don't want the person to get away with it, Rollo Tomasi. That's what detectives do. We don't want a Rollo Tomasi. We don't want the person to get away with it. This individual thought he can get away with it and did for a very long time. But fortunately, technology finally caught up with policing and got what we got, and a plea for the rest of that person's life in prison.
Now, I apologize to the other guests outside of Laura, because I'm going to go a little heavy with Laura here because we have about 15 minutes left with her. Her YouTube channel is The Engle Edit. Not only is she a News Nation anchor and courtroom reporter, but she, in her spare time with her husband, go out and put together an awesome YouTube channel, The Engle Edit. So check that out. I love Detective Mike and the whole panel. Got some crazy audio hiss going here. But Laura, in relation to where that video that we were just watching with Rex in court, were you in? I know there was overflow rooms for the media. Were you in the actual courtroom, or were you in an overflow room?
No, I was in the actual courtroom. I was just behind him as I was watching it. The reason I kept looking at the screen is because, you know, you can't really see the front. So the video and the photographer were in the jury box. And that is very rare, by the way. We always get stills of Rex Heuermann, but to have the video, it was a huge deal. They did shut the camera off right when he got to his allocution, but they did allow video of him coming out and talking to the judge, and we could hear his voice. We could hear the words. We could see him in a way that we haven't really before. I think that maybe there was one other time when he was first arrested, but this was a really big deal to have the video. So I was just about 3 to 4 rows back from him. And again, sitting on that divided row of media and then the right side. And I felt bad. I mean, it's a shame that there wasn't a bigger courtroom, because there were people that have been covering this case for a really long time that were standing in line. And, you know, they were moved to, I think they opened up 2 separate courtrooms for the live streams. So that, and then there was the members of the public and people that just couldn't get in. But yeah, it was quite something. That, I mean, the air was heavy. I mean, just all of it was heavy. And like I said, there were a couple of people crying. And really what struck me was the women, the older women that were down the road for me. I was watching them kind of just working their hands and watching them look over and trying to get a look at him and his profile and to hear the words and to feel that emotion from them and that tension and anticipation of what this moment was. Finally, some answers, not all the answers, but at least some answers as to who was responsible for the death of their loved ones.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to you with a follow-up, but we've got Lisa Mitchell here with a super chat for Detective Mike. Do you think he pleads guilty to avoid more embarrassment because of his internet searches, Mike? Do you think he was afraid for people to know that he was searching whatever he was searching, which I'm afraid to know?
Yeah, perhaps. You know, again, this guy's a narcissist. He thinks he's smarter than everybody. He cares more about how he's going to look. So him pleading guilty, he wins, right? He doesn't have to listen to anything. He doesn't have to be cross, right? He wins. He wins with this plea of not guilty. So it's kind of like a shame because, you know, Dr. Casey said that he's directing everything, right? He's calling the shots.
Yeah. Laura, we're going to forget this guy's name, and I love that David Sarney won't say his name, but for the purposes of today, you know, he was front and center. It's Michael Brown, his attorney, and I'm going to, once Laura goes, I'll play the rest of the videos, but Laura has seen everything and she has all the insight, but Michael Brown happens to be a very tall guy himself, as were the bailiff standing next to him. I mean, what is Rex Heuermann's presence like when he walks in? I assume everyone sees him because he's this enormous guy. How frightening must this have been for these female victims?
I mean, all of these victims were about 100 pounds. They were all about 5 feet tall. So when you think about that, and I was thinking about it the other day, I mean, just put your hands on your own face and feel how small that feels. And you think about the size of Rex Heuermann. He's not just a tall guy. He is a massive human being. It reminds me of when I used to cover locker room in Sacramento, where, you know, the basketball players would come out and they are so big. They're not just tall. They are extremely large human beings. And the power that he would have over somebody that was 5'4", 9" in one of the cases, 100 pounds, 105. I mean, are you talking about killing somebody with just one hand? Is it two? When did he decide to do it? Did he snap? Was it something that he premeditated? It sounds like he did. But those are the things that are so striking when you see him enter the court. And in the very beginning, when he was a little bit bigger, there were times when he required two sets of handcuffs. So he had a cuff, and then they had to join them together to get his hands behind his back. So, I mean, this is an extremely powerful looking human being that walked into the room. You could feel it. You could see it. You could sense it. You could hear it.
Laura just froze up there for a second. Dr. Jordan, to you, this question is for you from Sully and Sam. Do you think he pled guilty so that he can somehow remain relevant, keeping details sort of dribbling out to be revealed slowly over time in the future? Is that part of his thinking? Oh, you have to unmute there. You still, let me see if I can help you there, Casey. Hang on one sec. You have to do it on your end. Oh, there you go. You're good. Go ahead.
I never muted myself to start with. Okay.
I love the COE then. Okay.
So I don't think he's trying to remain relevant. And that's not really the word. I think that he is doing this to minimize. So here's the thing. Traditionally, serial killers have loved the limelight, but this one has some really dark stuff in his internet searches, including child pornography, right? That's the kind of stuff that will get Bubba very interested in you when you become incarcerated. So I don't think he's trying to remain relevant so much as trying to minimize the details of what a prurient, aberrant sex fiend he is, all right? Mm-hmm. And please keep in mind, he's probably had sex with hundreds of sex workers. He didn't kill them all. I mean, he killed at least 8 that we know of. But I mean, the bottom line is he's going to say he's doing this to spare his family and to spare the victim's family. He's doing this because he doesn't want all the details, and the evidence is overwhelming, to be made public. This would be a court TV bonanza, if you will. This would be all over the news. And he may be 6'5" and he may be 300 pounds, but when he gets to prison, if they think that he's actually killed young women, and we know he has, not necessarily children, but that he has an interest in child porn, which was brought out in his internet searches, he is going to be prey. He was referred to by the roommates of one of his victims as an ogre. He looks like an ogre, but I don't think this guy is going to have a prayer in prison. He's tall, but he doesn't know how to protect himself. He's doughy, but he's arrogant. I really think that he's going to have to sleep with one eye open and probably will end up in protective custody, sitting by himself in a cell by himself, because there are going to be some mean people who want to show him who's boss when he gets to prison.
Yeah, I generally don't wish ill on anybody, but, you know, he'll probably be fed to the wolves. And even though he's a big dude, to Casey's point, I don't think this guy is that capable of protecting himself against someone that's at least similar in size here. Mike, I don't want to put you on the spot. It looks like we may have lost Laura. She was having an issue, but huge thanks to Laura Engel, who was inside the courtroom today, and you heard the most important stuff from her. And she's got her YouTube channel, The Engel Edit, and she's also on News Nation. You'll see her on there tonight discussing this case. But Mike, what do we know? There was a lot of talk today about another victim, but has never been tied to this case, and that's Shannon Gilbert. What do we know about her, Mike?
Oh, my God, Joel, you're really putting me on the spot. Maybe Dave help me on that one, because I've got some
details on that. And Casey, go for it. Why don't you? I mean, I've got details, but go for it, Casey.
All right. Let me tell you what I know about Shannon Gilbert, because in the spring of 2011, I was covering two things. I was covering Casey Anthony trial and Long Island serial killer constantly, all day long. And here it is in a nutshell. Shannon went missing the previous October, I believe. Oh, no, sorry. She may have been missing like in April. And
she disappeared May 1st, 2010.
May 1st. That's it.
Oak Beach, Long Island.
Correct. Now, I was contacted by some journalists at Stern, the German magazine, and they were convinced that Joseph Brewer, who was the guy who hired her off of Craigslist to come and have some sex work with him that night, they were convinced that he was the guy. And if it wasn't that guy, it had to be the doctor or the neighbor, you know, that Shannon ran to. So here's the deal. I interviewed Joseph Brewer, the last man to see Shannon Gilbert. And I'm telling you, we met at a Denny's in Long Island. He had braces on his teeth, even though he was in his mid-40s. We had pumpkin pancakes. And I was never more creeped out in my life. And I was convinced I was talking to the Long Island serial killer. Wow. I could not be more incorrect. I was wrong. Never was Joseph Brewer. But he gave me a lot of insight because Shannon came to his house. They negotiated. He was very unapologetic. He was in a separation from his wife. He did at times hire sex workers. Shannon was doing this. She had a dream of becoming a professional singer. She was trying to make enough money to get into the field. Shannon ran from the house. How to say this nicely? She was under the influence. And she had some kind of disagreement with Joseph Brewer about the kind of sex work that she would perform for him. And at one point, he decided he did not want to go forward with their contract. She said something to him that insulted him, made him uncomfortable. He went outside to get her driver to remove her from the house. She did not want to leave the house. She called 911. She said, "These men are trying to kill me," as Joseph and her driver, a guy named Michael Pack, tried to remove her from the house, take her back to the city. She was under the influence. She was hysterical. We have the 911 phone call. And finally, she just went running from the house. She went and pounded on the door of a neighbor and kept running. Michael looked for her. That was her driver. The police came out. They looked around. They never found her. In a nutshell, when she was finally found, we do believe that she died, if you will, of natural causes. She ran into the swamp, got bogged down in about 2 feet of spring mud. It was very cold. It was close to 30 degrees that night. Wow. She was under the influence. She may have OD'd, but she collapsed in the reeds in the swamp and eventually drowned. We don't think Rex had anything to do with that, nor did Joseph Brewer or any of the neighbors. It's incredibly sad, but based on the remains and how they were found. First, they found her phone. Then they found her purse. Then they found her shoes, like spread out in a long line. We do believe she just ran into the swamp and finally succumbed to the elements.
But Casey, isn't it true that because of her, they ended up finding these other victims, Melissa Bartholomew, Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Megan Waterman, Amber Costello. So in an odd way, she helped push the case along.
Not, she is the hero, honestly. She is kind of the guardian angel of these women. Because the search for Shannon, where did she go, led a local police officer who was training his canine to the beach looking for Shannon. And he ended up, the dog alerted on the four bodies that are known as the Gilgo Four that were buried on the beach. If it weren't for Shannon, sad ending to her story, running away and the search for her as a missing person, we would never have found those four bodies on the beach that started the whole investigation.
Yeah. COE's panicking. I know I've got all that sound. There are a lot of things to cover here that I'm going to play sort of back to back, but I want to go back. It's not often, if ever, that you get to see inside a Long Island courtroom. So this is where I left off with Rex Heuermann. Let's watch another couple of minutes of this. And then
we'll now a defendant ordinarily retains the right.
Give me one. There we go. Oh, why is that happening? We do it all here. Let me see.
In this case, however, as a condition of the plea agreement, you are asked to waive your right to appeal. An appeal is a proceeding before another court, and if a defendant cannot afford the cost of an appeal or of a lawyer, the state will bear those costs. On an appeal, the defendant may, normally through his or her lawyer, argue that an error took place in this court, which required a modification or a reversal of the conviction. A reversal would require either new proceedings in this court or dismissal. By waiving your right to appeal, you do not give up your right to take an appeal. But if you take an appeal, you are by this plea and now separately by this waiver of the right to appeal, giving up the right to have the appellate court consider those claims of error, including, for example, rulings on evidence, discovery, suppression, and any pretrial motions, and whether this sentence is harsh or excessive and should be modified. You understand that?
Yes, I do.
And your attorney's explained this to you?
Yes, he has.
And Mr. Brown, I ask you at this point, are you, with respect to the motion pending?
We're going to withdraw that motion.
Application granted.
Thank you.
Are you willing to waive your right to appeal in this case in return to the plea and sentence agreement?
Yes.
Do you waive your right to appeal voluntarily of your own free will?
Yes, I do.
Are you entering this plea bargain voluntarily of your own free will?
Yes, I am.
Has anyone forced, threatened, or coerced you with the plea and guilty?
No.
Are you under the influence of any drugs, medication, or alcohol right now?
No.
Are you under the influence of any substance which has impaired your ability to think clearly or understand what's going on here today?
No.
Do you understand that by pleading guilty, you're waiving any defense you may have in this case?
Yes, I do.
Now, do you understand, again, an obvious question, but I have to ask it. Do you understand that as a result of this plea and sentence, you will be convicted of a felony and that such conviction will result in an enhanced sentence if you are convicted of a felony in the future? Do you understand that?
Yes, I do.
All right. Mr. Brown, again, another silly question, but have you received a sufficient amount of discovery, Ms. Brown?
Certainly have.
The people, have you provided that?
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, my promise is to sentence you in a manner that's conditional. At the time of your sentencing, I will be provided with a pre-sentence report and perhaps additional information about you and your alleged involvement in this matter. If after reviewing all the relevant information, I learn something which tells me that I cannot with conscience keep my promise, I shall permit you to withdraw your plea of guilty, reinstate your plea of not guilty in the case of proceed to trial. You understand that?
Yes, I do.
Additionally, my promise is also conditional on the following things. You must cooperate with the probation department. You must not be arrested for any offense in this or any other jurisdiction. Finally, you must appear on the day I set for sentencing or any adjourned date. If you fail to abide by any of these conditions, I will not be bound by my sentencing promise to you, and you will not be permitted to withdraw your guilty plea. Further, I'll be at liberty to sentence you to any appropriate sentence, including the maximum sentence allowed by law. Do you understand that?
Yes, I do.
Now, other than the promise that was placed on the record by the people, has anyone, myself, your lawyer, the prosecutor, or anyone else made any promises to you in return for your plea of guilty?
The only thing I want to interject, Judge, Mr. Tierney has indicated in exchange for the pleas that we're going to enter into this morning, there'll be no further prosecutions on the eight victims that he's referenced. He is also, my client is also obligated to completely, truthfully, and fairly cooperate with the Federal Bureau of Investigation's Behavioral Analysis Unit as part of what we've just discussed.
Well, that's it. He's got to talk to the BAU, which I'm going to circle back to Casey about. Detective Mike, to you, according to reporting, which is I was going to ask Laura about this, the families in there, while he was emotionless, were crying, listening out for the individual names. What is that, from your perspective as a detective, if you work this case, how does that hit home on a day like today?
I mean, you feel for the family, right? They finally see this guy in court. You know, this guy is a monster that they built up in their minds, and there he is pleading guilty and saying how he murdered their family members. It's a lot of emotions. He's not showing any emotions. I'm not sure if the family gets complete closure because, you know, he didn't disclose a lot of information. Maybe it would have been too graphic anyway. Who wants to put a family through that? Dave's worked and hunted like for homicide suspects. And, you know, when you're looking for somebody, it builds up in your mind like this big, horrible person. Then when you finally sit with them, and I don't know if they got that here, but when I finally caught somebody, I'm talking to them. I was like, wow, this guy's a human being. And I was a little bit weird, because it's so built up. And I think that's what it is for the family members. It's so built up. And finally, here it is. He's confessing. And I hope that brings them a little bit of closure.
Yeah. And it's all our fault, the media, because we build up this, I don't know, aura of serial killers. You know, they're kind of like lionized and glorified, but they are just human beings and usually weak underneath that tough exterior. I think a lot of them are probably fairly easy to break mentally. Casey might disagree with me. I don't know. But David Sarney, to you, I think it was the county sheriff was there. I'm not sure the law enforcement hierarchy in Long Island, but he spoke about how he thanked the county jail for basically completely reorganizing itself to house Rex Heuermann for these last couple of years. What do they have to do to accommodate this guy? Because he was definitely a target. You heard Casey say he's going to be a target in prison, but they had to isolate him in that Suffolk County jail.
When you're talking about that Sheriff Toulon, and he's been around a long time, when you're talking about reorganizing it, you had a this is a special category type of person. This is the highest of high profile. You don't want anything. And I like what he was saying is we didn't want him to have any appeals based on the treatment he received in while he was being held pending his trial. So that's what corrections does. I mean, sheriffs are the corrections part. So they're monitoring him, doing what they're supposed to do. Because you don't want to have anything to deter from the trial aspect of the case by having poor housing or poor treatment by the deputies that are there or anything along those lines. When they talk about that, I guarantee it's more like they probably had to allocate resources by having more deputies available to maintain that housing, to seclude him, like a specialized housing unit or like a SHU. In Rikers, you have the SHU, that specialized housing unit, where it would be kept away from the general population, because you want to make sure that there's no avenue the defendant can say that he was mistreated while awaiting trial, that he was withheld food or he was beaten by the correction staff. So that's why I think he did that. Everybody's a part of this case. I always say everyone is a part of this, no matter what happens. The criminal justice system has a lot of wheels to it, a lot of actors. Corrections is one of them. Even just holding him and detaining him pending trial, that's their responsibility. And that's why the sheriff, praised his guy, praised his staff and the deputies for keeping him safe to an extent, because you don't want this guy getting killed in jail, because you want to make sure that he gets his due time at court. That's what they're doing.
Yeah. Just ask Justine to Dr. Jordan. Do you think his wife, Ace Ellerup, this is Rex's wife, now believes he's guilty? She said in an interview she would only believe it if it came from him. Well, it came from him today. Does that end, the uncertainty for her?
It will take a very long time for her brain to adjust to this reality. You have to understand, for her, 25 years married to him, to find out he is arrested for killing these women, something that she truly believes he's incapable of because she's never seen that side of it. This is for her like falling off a cliff psychologically. It makes her question everything about her life, her marriage, her judgment. She's had these last year or so to slowly adjust to the reality, and she's going to need even more time. The thing is that he killed most of these women while his wife was out of town. She was visiting relatives in Iceland, where she's from. And I think that she's going to suffer from a lot of guilt. Like, if I was around, would that have stopped it from happening? Why was he seeing sex workers? Was I not a good enough wife? This is normal, but I think she has a decent support network. I think it's great that she has the support of her attorney. She's going to need a lot of counseling. The bottom line is she accepts that he's guilty now, but understanding it and then actually acclimating to that reality is a very slow process. I personally do not like it when people say, how could she not have known? She did not know. He was incredibly successful at compartmentalizing the killer side of him and the family man side of him. And we cannot blame the family, his wife, his daughter, his stepson, for any of that.
That's so crazy. And this is a house, and it's under 2,000 square feet. Massapequa Park, by the way, I talked about this earlier, is like an impeccable, what's that show where every house is perfect with a white picket fence, the movie, but whatever. It's like that. Yeah. And this house definitely stood out. It's hard to imagine, but I agree with Casey, and you've got to take her at her word, barring something else, barring a new investigation into her or something. But for now, we have to take her at her word that she didn't know. And these guys are good and they are cunning. So, you don't know. Maybe she really did not know. That's what it appears. That appears to be the case right now. This is Michael Brown. Now, this is the attorney for the ogre. This is him speaking outside court right after this all went down.
Guilty. Now, as attorneys, we've counseled him. We advised him. But that decision is ultimately up to the defendant. He controls his case, and that's his prerogative. That's his right. And that's what happened here today. When Rex decided that he wanted to accept responsibility and didn't want to proceed to trial, From a defense standpoint, we then pivoted and did our best to protect his interest. That included the fact that he's going to cooperate with the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the Behavioral Analysis Unit, and as you heard the district attorney, there will be no further prosecutions in regards to these eight victims. The district attorney's office of Suffolk County did an excellent job. I'll commend them. They deserve all the accolades. I've been reviewing this case for over 2.5 years. I can't express to you, and I know we've talked about it on many different dates, the volume of evidence and discovery. They did a great job. They really did a great job of gathering the evidence, going down. They went down hundreds of rabbit holes. And when you look at the amount of evidence and you connect the dots, they really did a great job. And I'm talking about the investigators, the detectives, their experts, the assistant district attorneys. So I know, I'm sure that the families of the victims are very grateful to the district attorney, and the people of this county should be as well. This was an unprecedented case, and I can tell you that I am very fortunate to have had a legal team that helped me on this over the course of the last 2.5 years. I don't know where Mr. Capone is, but and Mr. Fuchs. They are excellent writers, and we battled this from day one, and we were prepared from day one to try this case. Chase Brown has been an excellent help in terms of everything we've been doing. He is a rising star in this county. My co-pilot, Danielle Koish, she really, really put together that Fry hearing. That was such a monumental hearing here in New York State. And she's organized and came up with such crafty arguments during the course of this case. So I'm really grateful for their help. We really were, in my opinion, zealous. We did our best to be competent and effective during the course of this prosecution in the defense. One of the things that I was very mindful of and made a deliberate point is we attacked the evidence. We never attacked these young ladies, these victims. That was never our objective. We never said a bad word about them, and they ran into some tough times. They were all beautiful young ladies. Their mothers, their daughters, their sisters, I can go on and on. But it was never about attacking them. It was always about attacking the evidence.
That is Michael Brown. Didn't rub me as much the wrong way. We also didn't see the parts that sort of rubbed me the wrong way earlier. But Mike, to you, what do you think Michael Brown is thinking tonight? You heard him say he's been on this case for the better part of 2.5 years. Is this a win for him when he sits back? He got tons of name recognition. He defends a serial killer, which not everyone does in their criminal defense career. How does he see this, you think?
I mean, I think for his career, it's a little bit of a victory, right? Because now he might have a little bit of notoriety. And I know Mike Brown. I've been on court TV with him several times. He seems like a really nice guy. I'm sure this was a daunting 2 years. Same as you. When I first watched it the first time, I was disturbed by it. Like mm-hmm. when he said he accepted responsibility and then he still wanted to look out for the best interest of his client. But watching it now, I understand what he was saying. He's just going to, you know, treat his client as best as he could to make sure that his plea is submitted. But I wouldn't call it a win, but I think it's a little satisfaction on his part because, again, everyone knows who Michael Brown is today.
Yeah. David Sarney, I assume you have to agree with that. The other thing he did, which you don't hear criminal defense attorneys doing all the time, is he really gave a shout out to the DA, to Ray Tierney, who we're going to hear from next and in just a second, but also to the detectives. He said, and I quote here, they went down hundreds of rabbit holes. You happy he went there at least to thank or at least not thank, but to notice and make it a point to point out that these guys, these investigators, are what basically led them to this point today.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and he's right. You know, the American criminal justice system is based on you getting the proper defense. Michael Brown gave him the best defense for these cases. That's what he's supposed to do. That's his job. And the job of the investigators is to create probable cause based on the evidence. That's why he's given the accolades he is, because And even Tierney said it well, very clearly going, we did not stop. We continued on. We thought we had enough. We went for more. That's what you have to do in this system, because you have to prove this case, even though it didn't go to trial, that the person committed the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. And with the mountain of overwhelming, damning evidence they had, in a trial, it's still a crapshoot. There is a chance you can create doubt. But he saw that there was so much evidence in discovery when they received the materials and going, how do we fight this? The Fry hearing, they fight. They didn't win on that. Now, I think that was where they put all, you know, they put everything to bear on that Fry hearing to see if they can get the DNA analysis disallowed. It didn't happen. And with all the other evidence, it was sort of like, well, we'll go to trial, but we're going to have to do what we're going to do. And a defense attorney attacks the investigators, the evidence, documentation, times, dates, and locations. He couldn't almost do that. It seems like he couldn't do that with this case.
Yeah. Dr. Jordan, so spill the tea for us here. Part of the, you know, the requirements for this plea agreement is to allow the BAU to interview Rex Heuermann. That is the behavioral analysis unit, the famous division at the FBI where the profilers are. Why are they so, you know, why was this pushed? What are they going to do? And what are they hoping to find out when they interview this guy?
Understand that what they do at the BAU is basically to build these profiles, which are behavioral typology analysis paradigms, if you will. We have to have a base knowledge of solved crimes, real offenders who are willing to give us the details of their thought process so that we can put the little variables into little boxes and help solve cold cases, unsolved crimes, isolate the unsubs, and talk about the most likely, probable behavioral aspects of crimes that we haven't solved. In other words, to do that, we need to depend on the killers to tell us what they were thinking, right? To come up with probabilities of other killers that we haven't caught. So we need them in order to build these paradigms. And yet we don't like to dance with the devil. So it will be a bit of a tap dance. I mean, he has agreed to talk to them because there is information about his thought process that can be very useful to solving other crimes and catching other serial killers. At the same time, I'm going to tell you flat out, they lie. They lie. And that's where the tap dance comes in. They have got to figure out when he's being very forthcoming and when he's not, when he's minimizing, and they all minimize. And there have been a number of serial killers that the FBI has talked to. I have to tell you, like Jeffrey Dahmer was an open book. He didn't understand what was wrong with him. He wanted to be studied. He was incredibly forthcoming about every detail. And yet others, BTK, Danny Rawling, David Berkowitz, they changed their stories 100 times and they just enjoy the attention of the FBI wants something from me. And that's the power control nature of things. So they are going to have some very experienced, seasoned FBI behavioral analysts doing these interviews. And there's no book for this. You figure it out as you go based on the responses that you're getting from your subject, and you shape your questions from there. But he may be completely duplicitous. He may just tell them the party line of what he thinks they want to hear. He may just lie and enjoy the game of getting over on the system even one more time because it gives him a power rush.
Are they starting in the same way that they're, you know, starting to look at football players' brains who have CTE? Are they looking at the brains of serial killers? Are they starting to study them?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot that's been done on them. A whole series. I think David Cantor and a number of neuroscientists have collected brain scans, if you will, both MRIs and CAT scans, and have found that there is definitely a pattern with the psychopath's brain. And it basically has a number of different elements, but a lack of dopamine, okay, which put the brakes on impulsivity. Mm. We have found that there are definite brain maladies of psychopaths who have killed. So, we would love to study his brain and scan it. He doesn't have to be dead for us to do that, to see if there is any kind of neuroscience behind his need for power and control in killing these women.
Yeah, Vesper Martini with the comment of the day right here. Hold back on the butter if he starts to make up stuff. Pull away that butter. Great idea. Vesper is one of our MVPs. I cannot do this without Vesper behind the scenes helping me all the time. And I can tell you, she does not make the same salary as an NFL football player, but she still helps. So I appreciate it. Here is Ray Tierney. We'll go through the rest quickly, but I want to cover this. This is the DA today taking a victory lap. He spoke for an hour and 20 minutes. We'll watch a minute or two of this.
He identified these women, lured them into Nassau County, murdered them, and left their bodies in Suffolk County. He thought that by killing them, he could silence them forever and get away with murder. But he was wrong, because it was these victims, these women, who refused to stay silent. First, that silence was broken by the victims' families, who advocated for their loved ones and agitated for justice. Then the noise grew louder through the ensuing investigation and examination of the evidence that the defendant left at or around the crime scenes, as well as on the bodies of the women themselves, that further told the stories of these victims and what had actually happened to them. It was this evidence that ultimately was put together by the task force that proved to be the defendant's undoing and led to the pleas of guilt in today's court proceeding. And it is in this way that these murders were solved. And while we in law enforcement, as well as our Suffolk County citizens, mourn the loss of these victims, we are also grateful to them and to their families, because without them, this defendant would have never been brought to justice and would.
That's that piece of Ray Tierney. David Sarney, to you. I mean, he sort of explains in a bit of detail that we haven't heard before, that he would lure these victims away with money. He used burner phones. He lured them from Nassau County into Suffolk County. And then he would dump the bodies across Long Island. You thought it was interesting, and I'm sure you still do, that we finally got some details out of a guy that we didn't really hear much from. How important was it for Ray Tierney to stay as tight-lipped as he did throughout this process?
He didn't want leaks in these cases, because when leaks come, then you have people start looking at the, you know, you don't want to lose the control of the case. They kept very strict control. Even when the plea agreement was coming out, it didn't come out from Tierney's office. It came out from the family. So that's where the media was grabbed on that. For whatever reason, they told somebody, and then it just blew up on that end. But they were always very quiet about this, and that's why you want a case to have and case to be. You don't want information leak out, because information leaks out about a possible witness or possible or evidence or anything like that. You don't want the media to jump on it, and that's really part of what these cases are. You want to keep that quintessential fact available in this case. You don't want everyone to know everything. You give them a little bit. And most of the stuff we had was based on the initial complaint reports about the missings and investigate DOAs. That's where you got most of it from, and a little bit of the investigation. But you never got all the details. And the idea of the strangulation, because, you know, people watch movies and TV and think strangulation's quick and easy. It isn't. These women suffered. It's painful to think about when these women had to deal with this guy. And that's why you sit there. And that's why detectives push themselves so hard, because you want to find this sap, this monster, and you have to get him. And they did. And that's why, you know, that's why everyone did a phenomenal job, and you needed leadership sometimes to bring it all to bear. And that's why you have what you have today.
I don't know if you caught that. I caught that. David Sarney getting emotional there, and he's not the first one. I've had literally dozens of law enforcement retired on here who get emotional. They take this job to heart. This is why I always back the blue. And they've seen things, you know, they go into their minds. They've seen things that we have not seen. And people who don't give them credit, I just will never understand it. Cause without these are the first guys you're always calling. So, kudos to Mike and David for their work at the NYPD, which happens to be the biggest and best police department in the nation. Mike, do you think that basically the fact that Rex Heuermann waved the white flag today and said no mas, like Roberto Duran, that it what does that say about the case that the DA had coming at them?
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of information, a lot of evidence, a lot of challenges by the defense that failed. I think he realized that it's just not going to be a win for him. So he just he took the plea of guilty. Since there's no law, he's no longer to be prosecuted. This is interesting. He's no longer to be prosecuted on these 8 cases. So I'm hoping when he's with the FBI's behavioral analysis unit, he will give more information that the FBI can work with, that maybe they can share with the family if they want that information. This guy's basically going to be like our Hannibal Lecter, right? He's going to be our expert because we're not psychopaths, right? We don't think the way he thinks. So we're going to learn from him. Hopefully he can help us solve cases in the future, or maybe some cold cases, right? But I'm hoping because he's with the BAU that he's going to disclose, like, you know, how he planned this. How did he elude the police for 10 years? You know, this is the information I want to know. I also want to know where he did the killings. He said they killed him in Nassau, took him to Suffolk, right? I wish they asked that in the press conference. You know, did it happen in the house? I mean, do we know? I don't know.
Yeah. No, those are great questions, and those should have been asked. Shame on the New York media there. But, Mike, I got to ask you, and I don't know if you're willing to reveal this, but who's sort of the craziest, scariest guy that you ever sat across from in an interview room?
It's so weird because it wasn't a homicide victim. It was actually a female that was basically laundering money out of her business. But when I was interviewing her, you know, I'm not an expert like Dr. Casey, but when I'm talking to her in the box, in the interview room, I could tell that this woman is a sociopath, maybe a psychopath. She had no emotion at all, right? I notified her mother. Her mother was in there, came in, and I was talking to her. The mother was visibly upset, right? And all this woman was saying was like, it's going to be okay, mom. She was like deadpan, scary, scary person. That was the creepiest thing. Just, you know, they know the lyrics, but they don't hear the music. It's weird.
How about you, Detective Sorney? I got to ask you. Oh, you're muted. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
As far as sociopaths, I have to say, you know, we talked about it once before, that BlackBerry trickster I had. I've been getting phone calls about him after the podcast with that. People are calling me saying, I was dealing with this guy. I was dealing with him before. We've seen guys like this. You know, we had an incident in the 19th precinct where they picked up a psycho. He bludgeoned this psychiatrist to death, and we didn't understand. And we had him, we brought him into the box for the, you know, Manhattan North Homicide was going to deal with that. It wasn't our case. We just flown in. And you could see in his eyes, there's nothing. There's just nothing there that works. For some reason, he found this woman and just bludgeoned and just killed her. And we didn't understand the reason as to why. Sometimes you never will. You deal with these people. I've dealt with pathological liars. I've dealt with people who are evil people in our sense of what morality is. But the concern is always that, you know, the quietest people, the ones you were always concerned about, the guy who just sit there, the screamers, never worried about, the still waters run deep. Those are the ones you look at going, that's something wrong with this guy. And you've seen it. I've sat there. Colin sitting there and never says a word. And you're like, that's not good. That's a guy you're concerned about. And that's why, you know, that's when your hair stand, you're in going, we better be watching this guy because he's going to do something.
I would never bring up this comment right here, and I will not comment on it, but WV West Virginia Brood said that. My dad, my own father, may he rest in peace, he used to do psychiatric assessments out on Staten Island. And not once, but twice, I came home and the poor guy got beat up. It wasn't the best at self-defense, but black eyes, broken nose from crazy inmates. So it was a scary job. And when you're like 10 years old and your dad gets beat up, that's like your superhero. It was some scary stuff. But luckily he did not do that for too much longer after it happened. After the second time, Carm screamed and got him out of there. And that was that. But Casey Jordan, who is the most imposing, frightening serial killer? And you've been in there with a few, and I need to unmute you. Let me do that. But who is the scariest person that you have spoken with?
You know, it's interesting because first you said imposing, And I would argue that the most imposing was a guy who looked a lot like Rex Heuermann. It was the serial killer, Kendall Francois, that I think I've talked about before on this particular podcast, who was 6'4" and 400 pounds.
Wow.
And just very imposing, just in terms of his size, his girth. And also his tell was that he would sweat rivulets, you know? Mm. So whenever I was getting close to the truth, and he would be stony-faced, of course, he would just get a complete saturated under his armpits, his chest would complete, his shirt would become completely saturated in sweat. So I knew I was, you know, getting warm. But the most scary, I have to say, wasn't Kendall Francois, the serial killer. It was a guy in Florida that I interviewed who was engaged in ritualistic killings, and his family was into some dark voodoo stuff. And he described things, including human sacrifices, that he grew up witnessing. And I don't think he was lying. I do believe that the family actually engaged in human sacrifice, and Santeria is not the right religion. It's a dark form of that, you know, black magic. And yeah, he scared the bejesus out of me, because he just was like, and this is how I grew up, and this is what I do. And he continued to be engaged in ritualistic killings because he learned it from his family.
Please don't tell me that was Miami, and if it was Miami.
You don't want me to tell you. I won't tell you.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Only in Miami, a scary place to be. Before I forget, because I almost did again, Dr. Casey Jordan is host. You see it right there. Criminal Appeal Podcast. Criminal Appeal Podcast. You're hearing how smart she is. She has interviewed these serial killers. Please like and subscribe. It is Criminal Appeal Podcast, and it would be criminal of me not to plug such a good podcast. So check it out. One last bit of sound.
Can I tell you real quick that my last episode was on Rex Heuermann? So if people really are into this, go straight to the podcast, because I just covered him.
Even better. There you go. You get more Rex time. This is now Maureen Brainerd Barnes' sister speaking, and then we'll get final thoughts.
Melissa Can, everybody calls me Missy, and I'm the sister of Maureen Brainerd Barnes, and this is my family. Well, some of it. First, I want to begin by thanking the district attorney, his office, the detectives, the FBI, the New York State Police, and the entire task force. For years, they never stopped. They carried this case with determination and heart, and our family will forever be grateful. We are forever thankful for the work that led us here. Finally, a sense of relief. The guilty plea brings solace, and I like to thank everyone who had a part in that fight for justice. Thank you to our lawyer, Gloria Allred. Also would like to thank the media for continuing to keep this case in the public eye. Today, it's not about the person responsible. Today is about the women's lives who were stolen. It is about their voices, their future, and their families, the love that still surrounds them. They are the reason why we are here. 19 years, I lived in the space between heartbreak and hope. Throughout these years, I searched for answer, for truth, for justice. There were moments when the weight felt unbearable, but I never gave up. Maureen was never forgotten, not for a single moment. From the day she went missing until today, she has been carried in every breath, every memory, every fight for answers. This has been a long journey of hope, hope that one day we would stand here and say her name with justice beside it. Today, that long, painful journey brings us to this moment. Our mission, our promise to Maureen, is finally met with accountability. For Melissa's, Megan's, Amber's, Jessica's, Valerie's, Sandra's, and Karen's family, I stand with you in deep love and understanding. No one should ever have to walk this path, yet here we all are, connected by loss, by strength, and the unbreakable bond of our loved ones. The bond some of us has created has been one that is unique in a sense that it did not form from a previous friendship or blood. It was created by trying to pick up the pieces of our world that had shattered in tragedy. And I am so grateful for us. To every family out there still searching, still waiting, still holding on, please do not give up hope. Even when it feels impossible, even when the years pass and the silence grow heavy, keep going. Your loved ones matter. They are not forgotten. And one day answers can come. Finally, to Maureen, the promise I made to you so long ago was simple. Sorry. I would never stop searching for justice for you through every year, every setback, every unanswered question. I carried you with me, and I kept that promise. And today, it has been done. Justice has finally found its way to you. Your voice was never silenced, your story never forgotten, and your life will always be more than the tragedy that took you. This moment is not the end, but a reminder that love endures, truth prevails, and hope never fades, because even in the darkest moments, justice will find its way.
Incredibly articulate and heartfelt. And today, again, and you've heard David Sarney say this, is about these victims here. Detective Mike Alcazar, NYPD's finest retired detective. You heard him say it's the quiet ones and David Sarney that scare him, not the screamers in that in the box. I love how he says that, which is the interview room. Mike, your thoughts on listening to this victim's sister, Maureen Brainerd Barnes' sister? She said, but she always lived somewhere between heartbreak and hope. Really powerful line. And that her sister was never forgotten. Your thoughts on this and your final thoughts tonight?
I thought Missy's statement was the most powerful statement of the presser. Full of emotion. I mean, I kind of wish that Rex Rurman could have heard that, but he's a psychopath anyway. He's not going to feel anything. But this woman, again, was the voice for all the victims. I think she put it so well. And I, like David said, this basically drives home why detectives, why investigators, why district attorneys do what they do. And it's all about these poor victims and these poor families.
Well said. Appreciate that. Detective David Sarney served New York City, the NYPD. Now he teaches at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, which is the best in the country. David Sarney, same thing. Your reaction to this, you went on to say that I stand with you. The promise I made was simple, never to stop searching for justice. And today, I don't think they get closure because people say they never really get closure, but they got a modicum of justice. This guy is never going to see the light of day. Your final thoughts? I got you muted here. My bad.
The pain doesn't go away. It's going to be there. And when they say closure, you don't get closure because they're no longer around. What you get is what you're hoping and at least some semblance of an answer. And, you know, there are tens of thousands of missings that families have no answer to. You're hoping that you would have someone who's found 34 years later with a family and just went missing because they don't want to stay at their home anymore. Like I said, missings are considered missing are okay. You can be missing. It's about the criminality aspect of them. This person found what he considered the weakest persons, the weakest people, the small, the forgotten. They're never forgotten. Detectives do this job because they don't want them to forget. And just you keep doing what you do. We don't want Rollo Tomasi's. And I hated not having a clearance on my case or an arrest. I hated it. It annoyed me, but I didn't have enough. What was beneficial about this case, they had not just enough, but enough resources to get the person, to get that Rollo Tomasi, and to get him to plead to these eight murders.
Well said. Last but certainly not least, she is the host of the Criminal Appeal Podcast. She is a criminologist. She's an attorney. She's a behaviorist. What is she not? She's everything. Dr. Casey Jordan. I mean, to Mike's point, he wishes that Rex could have heard this. There'll be victim impact statements on June 17th for sentencing. If they force Rex Huerman to listen to Missy's statement, what would his response be? Oh, I have you muted. That's my fault. Here we go. I got you. Go ahead.
We always think that we can get through to them. You can't. You never will. You could play that statement and he would just be having, you know, probably Wagner playing in his head through the entire statement. They don't care. I've interviewed enough serial killers. And one of the tactics they always use when, you know, I go and do these these interviews with psychopaths, with people like Piers Morgan. They love to lay the pictures of the victims on the table and try to get a reaction. And they're just like rolling their eyes. They're like, do you think I feel anything? This guy doesn't feel anything about the women or their families that he destroyed. And you're right, there is no closure. I've interviewed enough family members, but they do move forward and they do it with our love and support. I have to tell you, Joel, I have one more comment. There's one unsung hero, and that is the roommate of Amber Costello. His name was Dave Schaffer, I think. He is the one who took note of the old green avalanche. When Rex Heurman came over to pick up Amber and there was some kind of controversy going on in the house and Amber didn't want to go with him, she called her roommate David to kick him out of the house. And as Dave was extricating the ogre, he was the one who called him an ogre, out of the house, he took note of the dark green Chevy avalanche in the driveway. That avalanche is what got this crime solved. When they got the new task force, they did a run on all the late model avalanches and they found one in Massapequa Park. And that led them to Rex. All the other evidence came after that. But without that roommate paying attention, I guess if I have one final thought for all of your viewers, pay attention. Those little details, right? Be aware of your surroundings. And I would love to tell you that you can see a serial killer, but they're all in our midst. There are probably 200 at large right now in the United States. So take care of yourself because you can't see them. You could be sitting next to one right now.
199 of them are probably in Miami, or like within a 3-block radius of me. But yeah, that's important. And you got to be careful. Please, on the way out, hit that like and subscribe button. It helps more than you know. We've got an active Patreon page that we're activating even more. Tomorrow night, just so you know, we've got a lot of asks on this. We're going to be covering the couple. The woman went overboard on a tiny boat in the Bahamas. Her name's Lynette Hooker. Brian Hooker is the father. The husband, I should say, and his stepdaughter is blowing the whistle on this guy. Tim Jansen's coming on to discuss it, and we'll have two other guests tomorrow night. So please join us at 7 p.m. Eastern tomorrow night. I always got to wonder when there's a couple on a boat, this is a tiny boat, and one stays on and one doesn't, what is really going on? That guy's going to get an onslaught from the media. And I guess ours is coming tomorrow, innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. But tonight, it is not about the ogre. It is about Maureen Brainerd Barnes, Melissa Barthelemy, Megan Waterman, Amber Costello. I mean, look how young and beautiful these women are. Sandra Costilla, Jessica Taylor. And you heard in that news conference, this is why we call it true crime. I mean, you heard the pain of Maureen Brainerd Barnes' sister. These are real families, real people. You've got Valerie Mack and Karen Vergata. So we got them a little bit of justice today through the district attorney in Suffolk County. But I believe that there is more to go here, and we'll stay on top of the story. Please join us tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. Love you, America. Love you, New York. Love you, Connecticut. And everyone stay safe and stay away from serial killers. Guests to Gremlins.